Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
I want to mourn the old trees and tell them that we love them.
I've looked at clear cuts and burnt forest and I've felt outraged.
We are the crowning glory of God's creation, and all of nature was made for us. Nature is more productive because of us, not less.
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
You got yourself proof, and you've got irrefutable proof. This is Wretched Radio, thrilled to pieces to announce a brand new free. Did I mention it's free? Resource at FortisPlus.org. It is our fellow Dr. Jason Lyle. He was in studio to not just present proofs of creation, but irrefutable proof of creation. It is available at FortisPlus.org. Going to give you a little sneak peek to wet your whistle. What you're about to hear are proofs that are like, okay, that seems irrefutable, and they're really, really good. But Dr. Jason Lyle's contention is they're not irrefutable proofs. He's going to share those that sound like they should be irrefutable, but then he will give us what is the irrefutable proof. If you'd like to hear the whole shebang, actually watch the whole shebang, because that's what you do with video, FortisPlus.org. Take it away, Dr. Lyle.
And I'd like to start by giving you some evidence of creation that is very good evidence that you feel free to share it, but it's not an irrefutable proof. And we'll see why that is. And I'm doing that so that you can see the contrast, so that you can see how this irrefutable proof is different from these other lines of evidence that are often used in the creation evolution debate. And when we're done with this, we'll find that the proof is not just of creation, it's of the Christian worldview as a complete system of thought. So that's very powerful. You'll be able to use this against other competing religions, false religions, and it'll work as well in them. But let's start with some lines of evidence for creation that are good, but are not quite ultimate. We could talk about information theory. There's a whole science dealing with information and how it's transmitted and so on. Dr. Werner Gidd is one of the world's experts on information theory, and he finds that information always originates in a mind. Now, it can be transmitted by non-intelligent machines. A Xerox machine can copy information, but it can't create brand new information. Only minds do that. Indeed, Dr. Gitt says, when its progress along the chain of transmission events is traced backwards, every piece of information leads to a mental source, the mind of the sender. This is very intuitive. If you come across a book and you start reading it, it's got useful information in it. None of you would assume that this book probably came about when a typewriter exploded. Right? You would assume that somebody wrote the book. Maybe not that copy. That was probably made by a machine that makes lots of copies simultaneously. But where did the machine get its information? Probably from a computer, which got it from another computer. Ultimately, it has to go back to a mind. And that appears to be a law of nature. There are no known exceptions to this. Information always originates in a mind. And that's very interesting because in the cells of our body, we have information stored in DNA. DNA is a very long molecule that occurs in the cells of your body, and it looks like a twisted ladder. And on the rungs of this ladder are nucleotide base pairs, and each group of three of those represents an amino acid. And then those are eventually read by, they're transformed into RNA, and then they're read by ribosomes, which produce the proteins which make you. It's absolutely amazing, I think. Glory to God for this process. It's stunning. And the reason you're a person and not a cabbage is you have instructions to make a person. Cabbage has instructions to make cabbage. And you got the long end of the stick on that one. So there you go. What we have in DNA is information. And we just learned that information ultimately originates in a mind. Now, that's perfectly consistent with what the Bible says about creation. In the beginning, God created. The mind of God is responsible for the information that we have in our DNA. It's been copied many times. And the copying process doesn't involve intelligence, right? It's just, there are machines that are themselves not intelligent, basically ribosomes that are able to read and transcript the DNA. But ultimately, the information originated in the mind. This is not consistent with evolution. In the evolutionary view, all the information in your DNA came about by chance. It came about by mutations. A mutation is a copying mistake in your DNA, basically a typo in your DNA. Often occurs when the cells are being copied and they have to make a complete copy of that DNA. There's a lot of instructions there. There's 3 billion base pairs in your DNA and you have 2 copies of it. So that's a lot of information. And when it's copied, that copying process is good, but it's not perfect. And so we have accumulated typos. in our DNA. That's why we all have little problems here and there that causes disease, basically. Now, evolutionists like to say that the reason we have all this information is ultimately all of it's a result of mutations. You get 3 billion mutations. In their view, we evolved from something that had much less DNA, much less information in their view. And yet, mutations do not add brand new information. All point mutations that have been studied on a molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information, not to increase it, according to Dr. Lee Spetner, PhD in biophysics, Johns Hopkins University. And this is his conclusion on the matter. He studied these for decades, and he finds that mutations don't add brand new information. And so they couldn't possibly turn something like a bacterium into you over millions of years of reproduction, natural selection, and mutations. It's not going to happen. Now, there are mutations that can be beneficial, and I have to point that out. Some mutations are beneficial in the sense that in a particular environment, they will actually help an organism survive. That can happen. But it's still by losing information. And so it's in the opposite direction to make evolution happen. See, if we evolved from bacteria, bacteria have some information in their DNA, but they don't have instructions to produce eyeballs and bones and so on. And so if we evolved from bacteria, at some point, they had to gain brand new information. Evolutionists say mutations do that, good mutations, but the mutations that are so-called good do not add brand new information. I'll give you one example of this, and that's antibiotic resistance in bacteria. So there's a bacterium called H. pylori, which causes stomach ulcers. And you don't like having stomach ulcers, so you go to your doctor and he gives you an antibiotic. The antibiotic, which your body cannot process, is absorbed by the bacterium. He's got an enzyme in him that's part of his system, part of his normal chemistry, that when it interacts with that antibiotic, it converts it into a poison, and the poison kills the bacterium, and you feel better until you get your medical bill. Okay? There is a mutated form of H. pylori that is missing some instructions, and he doesn't have the ability to produce that enzyme, or at least not very much of it. And so when the antibiotic goes into him, it just sits there. He can't break it down into the poison. And so he survives, but he survives because of less information. He survives because he's lost some instructions. And by the way, these bacteria don't compete so well with the ordinary bacteria in the wild. But you find in hospitals, these guys thrive because there's a lot of antibiotics there, and the ordinary bacteria have been killed off, and so only the mutants survive. This is an example of a mutation that under certain circumstances helps an organism survive, but it does so by removing information. It is in the opposite direction to make evolution happen. Dr. Spetner says not even one mutation has been observed that adds a little information to the genome. So where did all the information in our DNA come from? Ultimately, from the mind of God. And we've lost some over the generations. We have. We don't have as much information as Adam and Eve had between the two of them. We've lost some. And that causes some problems. But that's consistent with what we would expect given creation and the fall. That's perfectly consistent. It's not consistent with what we would expect if evolution were true, whereby we're supposed to be made of information increasing mutations. But that's just not what we find. I could also talk about the time scale of origins. The evolutionists require billions of years to make their idea sound plausible, but the Bible indicates that God created in 6 days, and it's clear from context those are ordinary, approximately 24-hour days, and that was a few thousand years ago by adding up the ages of the patriarchs and so on. And there's a lot of science that is consistent with that. There are certain processes in nature that can't last millions, let alone billions of years. For example, the decay of carbon-14. C14, you've heard of carbon dating. A lot of people have the misimpression carbon dating is what evolutionists use to get the millions of years. It is not. There are other methods they use that they think supports the millions of years. Carbon dating is our friend. Carbon dating tends to give answers that are pretty consistent with the biblical timescale. Maybe not exactly, but they're close to it. They're certainly not millions or billions of years. It's based on the fact that C14 is unstable. C14 is a variety of carbon that has two extra neutrons. Most carbon is C12, because it's got the 6 protons, 6 neutrons. There's a variety of it that has 2 extra neutrons, which makes the nucleus unstable. C14 really doesn't want to stay C14. And it will decay, that is change, into nitrogen automatically. You don't have to do anything to it. C14, it just sits there and, you know, a given atom will pop and it'll change into a nitrogen atom. And it'll emit energy when it does that. And the half-life of C14, the time it takes for half of the atoms of C14 in a chunk of material to decay into nitrogen is 5,730 years. So it doesn't take anywhere near millions of years for C14 to decay into nitrogen. And yet we find C14 in diamonds that evolutionists believe to be 1 to 2 billion years old based on these other radiometric dating methods, but they still have C14 in them. They can't be anywhere near billions of years old. They can't even be 1 million years old. After 1 million years, every atom on Earth would have decayed. If the entire Earth were nothing but C14, after 1 million years, they would have all decayed into nitrogen. It just doesn't last that long. Now, C14 is produced in the upper atmosphere when cosmic rays bombard nitrogen atoms and convert them into C14, and then they decay back over time. But these diamonds are found deep down in the Earth, well insulated from cosmic rays, where there's no reasonable method to make new C14 atoms, at least not in the abundance that we see. We find them in fossils. We find dinosaur fossils. If there's enough collagen left in the dinosaur remains, you can carbon date them, and we get thousands of years. Everyone we've tried. You don't get millions or billions of years with dinosaur remains. So carbon dating is very consistent with the biblical timescale. Very consistent. And it's not remotely what you'd expect if you believed in millions of years. I have to tell you, as a physicist, if I believed in millions of years, this problem would keep me up at night.
You're intrigued, aren't you? As well you should be. This is going to be how many did he do?
I think 13.
It's a lot. We'll be launching one every single week. Do not miss an episode of Irrefutable Proof of Creation at FortisPlus.org. This is Wretched Radio.
You know that moment at 3 a.m. when you can't sleep, everything is quiet, and you're alone with the truth about who you really are versus who everyone thinks you are? Your wife trusts you, your kids look up to you, the guys at church think you've got it all together, but you know better. You know the secret battles, the deleted history, the promises you keep breaking to yourself and to God. Here's what took me way too long to figure out. You can't fix a spiritual problem with human solutions. Accountability software won't change your heart. White knuckling it through another week won't either. And Todd Friel is getting to the heart of this issue with his resource, Play the Man. It doesn't give you another list of rules. It shows you how Christ actually changes men from the inside out. How he replaces the wanting, not just the doing. The man your family deserves, that guy is possible, but not through your own strength. It's going to be through the strength of Christ working through you. Play the Man. It's available now as an ebook, an audiobook, and a video series only at FortisPlus.org, because real men know when they need real help.
Would you like the university experience without the, you know, university experience? The Masters University invites you to visit their campus, or you can visit them online at masters.edu/wretched to discover a Christian college that is biblical, that offers all of the academic excellence you desire. Sports, athletics, arts, communication, all of the activities of, you know, a secular university without the, you know, secular parts. Please consider the Masters University online, or of course on campus learning, undergrad, masters, and doctoral programs. It's Masters University, the university with the university experience without the university experience. Masters.edu/wretched.
369 million. That's how many people are a part of the New Apostolic Reformation movement. And if you've never heard of it, that's part of the problem. Maybe you have heard of Jesus culture. Maybe your teenager listens to their worship music. Maybe your church sings their songs on Sunday morning. But you don't know what they actually teach and where it leads. Drunk in the Spirit pulls back the curtain on one of the most destructive forces in Christianity today. Who are these people? What do they believe? And why should it matter to your family and your local church? This isn't fear-mongering, it's education, because you can't guard against something you don't recognize, and this movement has tentacles in places you wouldn't expect. If you care about protecting your family and your church from false teaching that sounds Christ-centered, but it's not, this is essential. Drunk in the Spirit, it is streaming now for free on Fortis Plus. Download the app on your smartphone, on your smart TV, or just simply go to fortisplus.org.
Hermeneutics. A vital part of biblical hermeneutics is an understanding of genre.
One genre we find in Scripture is an epistle. Epistles are letters written to the church at large or to a specific church, which contain doctrine, theological arguments, and practical application. God uses first century correspondence to deliver his timeless truth. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Well, this is a breath of fresh air. This is Wretched Radio. It isn't often that you hear somebody who has dedicated their life to a particular field of study say, mea culpa. What we've been teaching and what we've been doing and how we've been instructing, it's been doing the exact opposite of what we have thought it would do. What is that field of study? I'm talking about psychotherapy. That's right, psychotherapy. There was an article in thefp.com. What in the world is the FP? That's what it's called. Thefp.com, written by Jonathan Alpert. He's written a book, interestingly, called Therapy Nation. I suspect he and Greg Gifford have a lot in common. Why? Because this secular psychotherapist is admitting that psychotherapy is not helping in many ways. It is hurting. Of course it is. It doesn't deal with the heart of the issue. It doesn't have any authority. Seriously, a question that I think that we Christians, we should just be slinging constantly, as often as Democrats, you know, hey, global warming or whatever their mantra is this month, whatever, they just repeat it over and over and over and over again. Here's the mantra for the Christian. Says who? Says who? How do you know that? I know you're telling me to do that, but what is your authority? What is your source? Because if you don't have one that is transcendent, I'm not all that interested. And just because you have a PhD, that doesn't mean that you have an authority that is not human. Because if it's just what people think, all you need to do is look through history to realize, wow, we certainly have changed in our understanding of reality. Science has changed. Medicine has changed. Well, there's just no constants when it comes to human philosophy and human worldviews. They're always changing. So why should we believe them? Says who? Well, Jonathan Alpert, who wrote Therapy Nation, salute to him. He wrote an article titled, Is Therapy Tearing Us Apart? This might, in a small way, minister to you if you are the victim of ghosting. This is a plague in our country. That's why we talk about it somewhat regularly here on Wretched. It is happening too often to lovely Christian parents whose kids are just saying, adios, mom and dad. If they even say adios at all, they just go. They block them. They don't ever return their texts. They're just out of there. Why? Well, this fellow, this secular psychotherapist, is willing to admit, I think that we secularists have played a part in it. Let me share with you from this article. A patient recently came to see me, saying she was furious with a friend. What began as an ordinary disappointment, it was a canceled dinner and a non-returned text. It actually was returned. Late had become something far larger and far more charged. The friend was now, here it is, drumroll please, toxic. The exchange had become, quote, a violation of boundaries. The hurt itself had been elevated into trauma. She had screenshots and a polished story about what the episode revealed about her friend's pathology. Have you experienced that yet, by the way? With the younger generation, although it has made its way into older generations. Therapy speak, everything is wrapped in this language of the therapeutic. And it sounds exactly like this, that I've been traumatized. That person is toxic. That person is narcissistic. Everything has got a label. Everything has a diagnosis. And by the way, speaking of which, this kind of grieved me today. I saw a thing. You know, a thing. I guess it was yesterday. It was on the tennis channel, I think. And by the way, speaking of the tennis channel, can anybody explain to me why the tennis channel is playing so little tennis these days? Quit talking about tennis. I don't want to watch you talk about that. I want to watch tennis. Just play the there is right now Roland Garros, the French Open. This is like one of the majors of tennis world, and they're not playing it. Who's got the rights to it? Why aren't they showing it on the Tennis Channel? Huh? I've got questions. Somebody better answer me. So they're showing a little biopic about a young tennis player. And they, okay, so this is a professional tennis player. He's in the top 100. He's actually won a tournament. He travels around the world. He's got trainers. He has meetings for sponsors. He's got management companies that take care of his schedule and who get him money for different appearances. In other words, he's functioning at a pretty high level. But as a child, he was diagnosed with autism. That kid is about as autistic as, well, I'll just go ahead and say it, Jimmy. Jimmy's not autistic. And neither was this kid, but they must have found, you know, some little box to check, some little, oh, you've got that. Therefore, you're on the spectrum. It just grieved my heart because he made it clear he's still autistic. You won't talk to somebody who's more normal than this kid. What have we done to our young people? We've slapped them with labels. We've made everything about emotions. The centerpiece of everything is how you feel. And that's bled its way into the church to boot. We live in, indeed, Therapy Nation, which brings us back to Jonathan Alpert, who wrote Therapy Nation, describing yet another client who has felt miserable because of the treatment that she received from a friend. We continue. The scene has become one of the defining features of my work as a psychotherapist. Too much of modern therapy culture keeps people stuck, reinforcing grievance, externalizing blame. The problem's out there. It's not here. It's out there. And turning everyone else into the reason their lives are so miserable. What does Christianity to say? If you've got a problem, if you've got a sin area, if you've got a deficiency, you need to work on it. Sure, you can address people harming you, of course. You can address other people, but positionally, we don't blame our issues on everybody else. We go to work on things, or we endure joyfully if we're being mistreated. Therapy Nation, you better just blame everybody else. You didn't get accepted into school? Blame somebody. You didn't get a good grade? Blame somebody. You don't have a date on Friday night? Blame somebody. It's never you. He writes, the problem begins with my own field. Salute to him for that. For years, my profession has trained clinicians to elevate validation over challenge, affirmation over interpretation. In other words, you're wonderful. We don't spend time going, what's going on in there? You're amazing. Why do you think like that? We don't do that anymore. Emotional fluency over the harder work of behavioral change. And what has followed is the rise of grievance culture dressed up as psychological sophistication. Wow, we live in a grievance culture, don't we? Too many therapists now function less as clinicians than as reinforcers of the most self-protective interpretation available, teaching patients to locate the problem everywhere but themselves. Psychotherapists better be careful. AI is going to put them out of work. AI will just affirm you all day, every day. Who needs a psychotherapist for that when you've got an AI? It's cheaper. Did you see the commercial, by the way? It's more about mental health. And you can get the help that you need for $15. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to trust my mental health to somebody on the end of an internet connection for $15. It's a flourishing industry because people are indeed hurting and they're stuck because of the very people that they're going to get help from. He writes, of course it's your boss's fault. Of course your colleague is toxic. Of course your ex is a narcissist. Of course the world keeps wounding you. It's a therapeutic frame. Frustration is rarely something to examine. It's something to assign. So if you feel injured, it's somebody else. And he writes, too much of modern therapy culture keeps people stuck, reinforcing grievance, externalizing blame. And by the way, his contention is it doesn't stay stuck in therapy world. It actually applies to friendships, marriages, and eventually politics. He actually blames it on the what do they call it? Donald Trump syndrome, I think. Is that what, like, people are just like, ah, this guy's a nightmare. And they just seem obsessed about it. He actually says, we're to blame for that. The political consequences flow out of this mindset. A citizen trained to experience ordinary conflict as evidence of harm will bring that into public life. And he says, we've seen that with Donald Trump. When members of my profession move from helping people navigate political differences to legitimizing family estrangement as a sign of psychological health, you've got a break from that. They voted for Trump. You can't go to Thanksgiving dinner. On national television, prominent therapists and psychiatrists suggested it might be essential for mental health to avoid Trump voting relatives during the holidays. That is Therapy Nation. And he finally concludes, this is where therapy culture ceases to strengthen people and starts quietly weakening them. The person becomes increasingly protected from scrutiny and increasingly fragile as a result. And that's why we believe in biblical counseling. And I would point you toward Greg Gifford's Transformed and Libby Glosson's podcast, The Better Way. It's biblical counseling because it has, what's that word that we need? Authority to tell you what's wrong and how to fix it. This is Wretched Radio.
And it is now time for your daily Fortis News Break, production of Fortis Institute. We begin in Virginia, where sanctuary politics can do again. An illegal immigrant from El Salvador was arrested in Arlington for sexually assaulting a woman in a parking garage. He already had prior charges for rape and sexual assault. After a brush with police last year, he was turned loose. And as Homeland Security put it, sanctuary politicians released this man, and a woman paid the price. That fight is now in court. The Justice Department is suing four Democrat-run states, Maine, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Washington, for denying federal agents the confidential license plates ICE uses to track fugitives and word missing child cases. These states hand those plates to their own agencies freely. But when Homeland Security asks, suddenly it's tyranny. And from the ballpark, a Christian gets vindicated. The Washington Nationals fired their community relations director after James O'Keefe caught him on camera admitting he'd kept picture Trevor Williams off the team's social media. Williamson? Well, he's a devout Catholic who objected when the Dodgers honored a drag troupe that mocks Christ. The team apologized and Williams answered by quoting 1 Peter on the cost of faith. On to election integrity now. A North Carolina judge ruled the state broke its own constitution by letting people who never lived there vote in federal races. North Carolina had already borrowed non-residents from state elections last year, then left the federal loophole wide open. The RNC sued and won. Apparently, you have to live somewhere to vote there. And in the strange but true file, a Delaware judge ruled that corporations can vote in the town of Fenwick Island right beside actual people. Mind you, Delaware has about 1 million residents and over 2 million companies. The ACLU sued. The judge waved it off as one person, one entity, one vote. So if these companies are people now, can we draft them? Finally, the Freedom 250 concert celebrating America's 250th birthday lost 5 acts last week, including Bret Michaels and the Commodores, who decided it had gotten too political. The fix from President Trump replaced them with himself. He floated an American is back rally, calling himself a bigger draw than Elvis and the greatest president in history. Man, where's the humility, President Trump? Say what you will. He doesn't get stage fright, does he? And that wraps up today's Fortis News Break. I'm Jimmy Hicks. If you want more, you can download Fortis Plus or sign up to become a Fortis Insider for exclusive daily content, both of which you can do at FortisInstitute.org. And don't forget, you can subscribe to Fortis News on your favorite podcast app in order to get these updates daily. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.
Know your reformers. William Tyndale provided the first complete translation of the New Testament into English in 1526. While he was in prison for the crime of translating the Bible, he continued to translate the Old Testament until he was strangled and burned at the stake in 1536.
This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Thank you. Thank you, seeker-sensitive movement. Not. This is Wretched Radio. It's been going on for years, and yet recently the Wall Street Journal, amongst other news outlets, they're identifying a trend, and it ain't a good one. Young people, they're emigrating. They're crossing the Tiber. I hope they're doing it legally. They're going to Roman Catholic churches. The trend is undeniable. Fox News has reported on it. Look at the kids. They're digging the incense and they're digging the old and they're digging the formal. What's going on? And I think the answer can be found inside of the seeker-sensitive movement. Started writing about this at least a decade ago. I wrote a book called Reset for Parents. It's a parenting book. And one of the chapters, I suspect, surprised people, especially back then, because the trend wasn't apparent to everybody, but I was hearing about it regularly because going to campus, you talk to young people and you discover, wait, you grew up evangelical. Now you're Roman Catholic. Why did that happen? You went from grace to works. What's happening here? And so I wrote a chapter saying, Mom, Dad, be careful because your kids, they're looking for ancestry. We should have known it. Ancestry.com. Everybody wants to know, what's my heritage? There's something inside of us. I still don't know what it is in our human DNA that says, I want to know who my relatives are. I want to know who I'm connected to. And it's not just your bloodline. It's your spiritual line. And I encourage parents, teach your kids about their Christian heritage, not going back to the 80s, or not going back to Charles Spurgeon, not going back to the Reformers, not going back to the early church fathers, but going back to the first century church in Jerusalem. There's your ancestors all the way back there. Everybody who's repented and put their trust in Jesus Christ, there's your heritage. And it's much bigger than any church claims that it is. That is your lineage. And if we don't teach them that, we're going to lose them. And guess what? The trend has continued. Wall Street Journal talking about it. The kids, they're just slamming these big cathedrals. And a part of it too is the building. Believe it or not, the building. They want something that looks like it's different than everything else. I don't think it's a sin to build a church that's a multi-purpose facility. I don't. But I do know this, that there is something about a church that does, it resonates with people. There's a church, they're over in Woodstock. We're in Alpharetta. It's another suburb called Woodstock. Pretty groovy downtown. Nice place to live. And there's a church, Faith Community Church. They actually built a church. And you know what it looks like? A church. It's like, that's a church. They'd been in a high school for years and they got to the point where they could build a church. So they did. Guess what happened? They opened the doors. Jimmy, how long has it been for Faith over there? About a year or two? Maybe? Nah,
maybe.
Barely. They're full. They've had to go to two services. Why? Well, of course, the preaching, the teaching, the evangelistic efforts. But I think it's also the building. People drive by and go, oh, it's a church. Oh, what is the read on a church? When you see something like that, that's being built, what does it speak? Architecture speaks. And I can't help but wonder if the reason that these kids are going to Roman Catholic churches is because they're glorious. They're awesome. They're awe-inspiring. They make you feel small. They give you a sense of the transcendent. And kids want that. And if we're not giving it to them, they're going to find it elsewhere. J.D. Rucker, writing an article titled, The Megachurch Built a Generation That Couldn't Find God in It. I would say megachurch / seeker-sensitive movement, because not every megachurch is a stinker. There are some very good megachurches. I know of them, and they are very sound. So I prefer seeker-sensitive, but nevertheless, the point is seeker-sensitivity and what embodies so many megachurches has caused this mass exodus. Let's dive into this. For 30 years, the dominant American church growth strategy assumed the way to reach the next generation was to make Christianity feel less like Christianity. Who else does this with their product? Can you imagine Coca-Cola? Hey, everybody, there's this beverage. Tastes a lot like Sprite. I guess that's a Coke product. What's a Pepsi product? We don't know here in Atlanta because we're the co-capital of the world.
Actually true.
Okay, so what? Lemonade. It tastes like lemonade. You really, if you like lemonade, you're going to like this product. What's the name of it? Never mind that. Just try to drink it, will you? Because it doesn't taste like the thing that we actually make. Who does that? Oh, yeah. The Evangelical Church. Lower the lights. Lose the hymnal. Trade the pulpit for a bar stool. Take out the cross. Put in an abstract panel. Wear your skinny jeans. Quote movies more than Moses. Make Sunday feel like a good TED Talk or rock and roll show. And that coffee. Yeah, mama. And it worked. It worked. And now the children produced from that strategy are vamoosing. They're not going where people expected. They're going to the Roman Catholic Church. They're not deconstructing into atheism. Just because a kid leaves an evangelical church, it doesn't mean they're deconstructing. Then this article reports there's less deconstructing going on. It appears we're through that trend, thankfully. And the first wave hit. It's played itself out. Now you remember the ex-evangelical movement? Yeah. Those podcasts are kind of, you know, they run out of material. How much can you complain? The I Left Church memoirs, they don't sell like they once did. But what are the kids doing? They're doing something else totally unexpected. I'm not surprised at this. I saw this years and years ago. They're showing up at Latin Mass, Anglican parishes, with kneelers and prayer books. What? We can't have kneelers. Up and down, up and down. You look like a jack in the box at the church. Guess what? The kids want it. Why? Because they know that's serious. Like, this isn't a condemnation if you don't have kneelers, and if you do church a different way. There's liberty in this. But the point is, the kids want something serious. We threw it all out to accommodate what we thought were the sensibilities of the world. And it turns out, after they were taken away, they're saying, we kind of miss them. We kind of like those things. They want something transcendent. They want something historic. And guess what they want? They want depth. They don't want trite. They don't want silly. They don't want life hacks. They want something that is just, there's got to be more to it. And what did they perceive? Well, Rome and Constantinople, they've got it. And Anglican communion to a degree. But I think it's mostly been Rome and Constantinople, the Eastern Orthodox Church, that have profited from the seeker-sensitive movement. And this fellow rightly asks the question, why? Why? He writes, the dishonest answers are easy. We can tell ourselves, well, they were never really saved. And then not just ignore it. And that's a possibility, by the way. We can tell ourselves they fell for aesthetics, incense, the vestments, the seduction of the old and the beautiful, and then just pretend it didn't happen. We can tell ourselves they were intellectually proud or just emotionally fragile or looking for an institution to do their thinking for them. While some of that is true, to simply put it into a box and then throw it on the shelf as if, well, we don't have to deal with it is a very big mistake. The main story is that the seeker-sensitive, the seeker-friendly megachurch promised them a Christianity that they could enter into without effort, without changing. And they grew up and discovered they want something that'll change them. Now, I grant you, a lot of what they are imbibing is tainted with some other issues. In fact, there was an article in, I guess this was the Christian Post, why being spiritual but not religious eventually faceplants. So a lot of these kids, they aren't maybe even getting into Catholic dogma yet. They're just trying spirituality on. And that never, like, will satisfy because it's not grounded in truth. So we want to make sure that we understand, you know, these kids, they aren't necessarily becoming thoroughly converted to the Catholic system. They're just looking for, they're groping. And they sense there's something there that I didn't get when I was in the megachurch when I was a kid. And they have gone looking for this. They've discovered a Christianity that says, no, we're going to expect more from you. Kneel down. Stand up. Say the rose, bibbidi bobbidi boo. Do stuff. Ooh, that smell. What is that unique smell? In this instance, it's not pot, it's incense wafting through New York City, and it's coming out of Roman Catholic Church doors. And the kids are sniffing it and they're going, I kind of like it. I kind of like it. They sense that it's different from this article. They were taught that Sunday was a celebration and they wanted to know what to do on Tuesday when their marriage was breaking up or their father was dying or their child was sick. They were given a worship band and they wanted a liturgy. Oh, that word. They were given a personality at the pulpit and what they wanted was tradition. They were given relevance and what they wanted was transcendence. Hip, groovy, even they get, it's passé, daddy-o. It ain't cutting it, and they're finding depth elsewhere. What is the moral to this story? Next on Wretched Radio.
You know those really big questions you get when your kid comes home from college? You know the ones about whether God exists, if the Bible can be trusted, why there's evil in the world, or what's wrong with everyone else's view on sexuality? Yeah, those. Road Trip to Truth doesn't dodge them. This resource is hosted by John Ferbarez, and it goes straight to college campuses and talks to students who are asking these very same questions. But it doesn't just stop there. No, no, then there are the experts that give the real answers, with topics like science and faith, pornography, social media and mental health, critical race theory, marriage, eternity, and that's not even the half of it. If you have teenagers, this is the stuff they need to hear before the world gives them its version. And if you don't have teenagers, you'll still learn something. Road Trip to Truth, all four seasons available right now on Fortis Plus for free. Download it now where you download apps on your smartphone, your smart TV, or just simply go to fortisplus.org. So you finally get that opening that you've been waiting for, that opening to tell a coworker about Christ. And before you get anywhere near the cross, he wants to know how a grown adult still trusts an ancient book in this current age of science. And right there is where the conversation will stall. It happens to believers constantly. And that stall is the exact thing Dr. Jason Lyle is dismantling. In Irrefutable Proof of Creation, his brand new series available on Fortis Plus, Dr. Lyle goes after the question that hides under the question. That's the assumption that science and scripture are opposed to one another. And Dr. Lyle dismantles that notion and he hands you a clean path back to the gospel, simple enough for the person that sits across from you to follow all the way. Faith was never blind, and the truth was never something that we get to vote on. Irrefutable Proof of Creation is streaming right now on Fortis Plus with new episodes every Monday. You can download the app on your smartphone, your smart TV, or simply go to fortisplus.org. Hey, thanks for listening to Wretched Radio today. If you're a man, you're trying to figure out what it actually means to be one, and you've probably noticed, well, the world doesn't make it easy. They say be strong, but not too strong. Lead, but you don't want to be toxic. Look, it's a lot of mixed signals, and after a while, you just stop listening to any of it. And the thing about it is, scripture is not confused. God has a lot to say about what it means to be a man, and Dr. Adam Tyson unpacks that every week on Way of Manhood. Dr. Tyson is a pastor. He's also a professor at the Masters University, and he's one of our Fortis Institute fellows, and he's not interested in cultural trends. He's interested in what the Bible actually says. And if you're an ongoing monthly gospel partner of Fortis Institute, it is your support that helps make content just like this possible. If you've ever been impacted by this ministry, would you prayerfully consider becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner today? All you have to do is go to fortisinstitute.org right now to find out what it would look like in your life to do just that. Wretched. Amazing grace, amazing gospel.
God has given the church many gifts for the building up of the body. One gift is exhortation, the spiritual ability to encourage, comfort, and admonish God's people. Whether God's people are oppressed, confused, or in error, God has provided the gift of exhortation to comfort, urge, and correct them. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
How can we recover? This is Wretched Radio. Before we lose more young people to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, is there anything we need to adjust? No, we don't want to respond and get whiplash. Hey, they're winning them with liturgy and incense. Let's start doing that. Hold the phone. Let's go back in time and ask ourselves a question about our Protestant history. What were they doing decades ago that we aren't doing today? What was the attitude about church 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that is different than the attitude of today? Ecclesiology. What is church? What did we used to think about it? And what are we thinking about it now? That is what we should examine. And then based on what the Bible says, make some adjustments. No, we don't want to become like a Roman Catholic Church. We don't want to become Eastern Orthodox. We don't want to be kissing murals on walls. We want to be Protestants. We want to be evangelical Christians. We want to be biblical people. But if we can learn a lesson from the mass exodus that we are seeing from kids going from evangelical churches to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, let's make those changes. Let's say, look, this we've adopted too much of a bad idea. Now, to varying degrees, some churches, they're just whole hog seeker sensitive. You know, they're doing this silly movie sermon series and all of that nonsense. That's a faceplant waiting to happen. Because it's just a big fat nothing burger. I'll bet those places are such a revolving door. They people come in, hey, this is so groovy. Hey, I lost my job and I don't have any comfort. I don't have any way to process this. And out the door they go. And then the new ones come in because this time they're doing a movie series based on Bruce Willis movies. Because we're hip and we're current. The seeker sensitive movement, in my estimation, has been honestly one of the biggest blights on Christendom in 2000 years. It has gutted the gospel. It has gutted the demands of Christianity. It has made Jesus look downright silly. Merchandise, tchotchkes, silly t-shirts. Really? We've so made Christianity an impotent affair. And guess what? The gig is up. People are on to it. They're getting it. There's nothing here for me. And they're leaving. What can we learn? What do we need to adjust? From the article, which is very helpful, the megachurch built a generation that couldn't find God in it. He writes, the reformers didn't build the modern megachurch. The reformers built churches centered on the public reading and preaching of the word, on serious catechesis from childhood, on a robust theology of the sacraments, on church discipline, on a sense that the congregation belonged to something that connected backward through the centuries and forward into eternity. So when the serious young convert looks at his Bible church and concludes, the Reformation failed, he's not looking at the Reformation. He's looking at what American evangelicalism has done to the Reformation. After 100 years of revivalism and pragmatism and consumer marketing, the young people they're just seeing the wreckage of Protestantism and blaming the architect for what the contractor did. What did we used to do in church? Here are some steps. Maybe your church can consider these things. Even if you're not a seeker-sensitive goof fest, maybe these are things that they've jettisoned. They've just been sloughed off over the course of the years. Maybe it's time to reconsider them. Number one, preach the whole counsel of God. All of it. All of it. I'm telling you, there are plenty of verses that I will run across in the Gospel of Matthew or 1 Peter where it's like, I wouldn't choose that subject. But Lord, you did, so we're preaching it. And inevitably what happens whenever that sort of text presents itself, and I, if you will, have to preach it, there will be people that say, really needed to hear that. Oh, so God knows best, does he? Preach the whole counsel, including Romans 9, Hebrews 6, 1 Corinthians 11, all of it. In other words, preach the verses that aren't appearing on a coffee mug at a Christian bookstore. The whole council. Number two, sing songs that have outlived more than a cultural moment. Hymns are not aesthetic preference. They are catechesis set to music. Music is every... The silly music, it's so massively popular, and it's just so mind-numbingly thin to me. I just don't get it. And it's not helping people. It doesn't teach them anything other than just one repetitious thought. What was the hymn that we talked about yesterday? What God ordains is always good. He is my friend and father. Now, you can just sit and dwell on that thought for a long time. And you know what that's going to cause you to want to do? Sing the other five stanzas. Why? Because truth motivates your emotions to sing your heart out. That's what music should do. And it should linger with you, and it teaches you. So when you go and you run into problems, you can sing, what God ordains is always good. He is my friend and father. Today's music. Number three. Treat the Lord's Supper like the Lord's Supper. Whatever your theology of the table is, it's not a snack. It's not an interruption of the service. It's not like, hey, everybody, we got to do communion before you go to Cracker Barrel. It's a big deal. Paul, he gave some instructions in 1 Corinthians 11. He said, be careful how you take it, because that is why some of you are weak, sick, and dying. It should be a very reverential moment, and it shouldn't be rushed through. Number four, recover catechesis. Not a 6-week membership class, catechesis. Multi-year, generation-spanning work, teaching Christians what Christians have always believed and why they believed it. If you've never considered doing catechesis with your kids, I would encourage you to check out some of the catechisms online. And think about it. Have them start memorizing. What do we do when, what do we say to kids when we say, time to memorize your Bible verses, time to memorize your catechism? We're saying, this is important. This is worth committing to memory. We know you don't like doing this. We're going to make you do it anyway. Because we know we're the big people. And we know not only do their brains get filled with Bible truth, but they also see, okay, my parents and the other people at this church, they're earnest about this. There must be something more to this. Number four, is that where we're at? Read the early church fathers. Read them. They're not perfect by any means. They're not perfect. I mean, there's all kinds of challenges in reading the church fathers, but go back and read them. We quote them regularly at Alpharetta Bible Church. We quote Puritans, Reformers, early church. Why? Because we don't have to say it. All right, if you're young, this is your ancestry. They just hear it and they get it. Take church history seriously enough to actually teach it. Let kids know there is a church history. These are things that we could be... Consider a more structured liturgy. I didn't say hum, swinging the incense cans. Something that is just perhaps more coherent, something that makes sense, something that is thematic, something that is organized. If you don't experience that in your church, I would almost bet that there are very few conversations between the preacher and the worship leader. We have given worship leaders an awful lot of control of our church services. And there's that so often the sermon is about something totally different than the worship experience, because the theme of the worship experience is an experience. It's not truth. It's not a particular theme of a theological truth. Instead, it's just intended to emote. And there can be so often a disconnect between the worship pastor and the worship leader and the pastor. That one's doing singing one note and the other one's singing another note. Why? Because it's not organized and it's not structured and it's not thematic. I'm telling you, it makes a difference. It makes a very big difference. We had a guest. I don't know if I shared that. We had a guest preacher at our church. I think I did. And we did this routine in the beginning. Okay, what's your sermon text? What's the theme of it? What are the points you're going to be making? Okay, here's the liturgy. Showed him the liturgy, said, cool, that looks great, proved it. We did the liturgy. And as soon as the service was done, the guest preacher turned to me and said, wow, that service, everything was so connected. He'd already seen it, but when you experience it and it's connected and it's thematic and the hymns are about the sermon and the confession is about the sermon, it makes an impact. Maybe we need to consider going back to that. Will you grow fast? No, probably not. But will you grow deep? You're not going to produce a national brand. And it's not going to get a pastor a book deal anytime soon. It's not going to fill up a stadium. You're not going to be doing mega conferences, but your young people will see that you are earnest. And this is serious. This is important. And this is historical. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.